Starting with you, let's just go around in the circle one more time with the names, just so we all get to know everybody's name. So you are?
Corey.
I'm Kat.
Sherry.
Lisa.
Olya.
Allison.
Paul. Carl. Richard.
Zed.
Barbara.
Amanda.
Keith.
Righto. Well, my first question is, how's it going so far? I know it's just started, but anybody got any complaints or wanting things to be different or comments or?
Complaints about the weather. I want to be out there walking.
Yeah, it is. It's. I know last time we had beautiful weather. But I think I heard it might be like this all weekend.
Good.
But I always heard English people are never daunted by the weather. They go out walking in the rain anyway. There's lots of nice places to walk, actually. I don't know, do you know about where to walk? You can, this isn't a closed retreat, so if you want to stay on a paved road, if you go up to the road, either way, you can walk through Grinov and out that way, or you can go to the right and take the first left, and if you want to climb a hill, go up to the top of the hill, and there's a great view. But I think what most people prefer to do is to go out the back door, or if you go out the front door, go around and go out this little side road over here, back driveway. There's a track, and you turn left on the track, and it goes down to the river, and it's a really nice river. And if it's too deep to cross it, if you go to the left a little bit along a trail, there's a bridge, and you can cross the bridge, and then you can go up over those hills, and that's really nice. You can also just go out here. And there's a little house over here, and there's a track. You just go out to the edge of the property, and you kind of bushwhack your way down and around. And there's another trail that goes along the river, and then you can come back that way through the forest, and that's really nice. Or you can kind of go along that track, and you end up at a lake, and that's really nice. And that's pretty clear how you get around from the lake around to come back. But do be aware of ticks, I think. You have to be aware of ticks if you're out in the bush. Not so much if you're on the road or that way, but if you go through the trees, I think you have to be careful and just check when you come back. I don't think anyone's gotten Lyme disease here, but apparently it can happen. And a friend of mine in Hexham just came down with it a few weeks back, so it is around. I'm not sure where he got it, but anyway, so those are nice places to walk. And I thought about it some more, and I think we will go all the way till 3:30, because I thought once you the line, you have lunch, and then you do your karma yoga. It's nice to have a good full chunk in the afternoon to have some free time, and those of us who have commitments to do, so we'll just go like 3:30 to 4:30, then 5 to 6. So let's just leave it how it was. Today we can, maybe we'll go a bit longer in the discussion anyway, just to get to know each other a bit more. I wanted to read you something I found in this book last night. I thought it was on page 32. I've lost it. Here it is. It's from a sutra, and it's about the mind of bodhicitta, which is what we'll be working with. And it says, actually, would you like to read it, Carl? I read a lot. It's just, do you have glasses? It's just this. From here to here, just to let other people do it. No, from here, start here, to there.
To there.
Yeah.
O child of my family, the awakening mind is like the seed of all the teachings of the Buddhas. It is like the field in which the positive actions of all wandering beings prosper. It is like the earth on which the whole world depends. It is like the son of the Lord of Wealth, who completely eliminates all kinds of poverty. It is like the father completely protecting all bodhisattvas. It is like the king of wish-granting jewels, which perfectly fulfills every purpose. It is like the miraculous vase, which acts to accomplish every wish. It is like a spear, vanquishing the foe of disturbing emotions. It is like armour guarding you from improper thoughts. It is like a sword beheading the disturbing emotions. It is like an axe felling the tree of disturbing emotions. It's like a weapon staving off all kinds of attack. It's like the hook which draws you out of the waters of psychic existence. It is like the whirlwind which scatters all mental obstructions and their sources. It is like the condensed teaching that encompasses all the prayers and activities of the bodhisattvas. It's like the shrine before which all the gods, humans and demigods of the world can present their offerings. O child of my family, the awakening mind is endowed like this with these and immeasurable other excellent qualities.
Oh, that was quite nice. Does anyone want to kind of give their idea of why it's so important, why it fulfills every purpose and accomplishes every wish and vanquishes disturbing emotions and staves off all kind of tack, drives you out of the waters of samsara, the whirlwind that scatters all mental obstructions? It's the heart of all the bodhisattvas. So what's so special about the mind of bodhicitta? Anybody want to take a stab at what it is? Why it's so special?
It's probably the one of the quickest ways to cut through ignorance, the root cause of all the delusions.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you, well, that's the opposite of the of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
So. And of the delusions and of your ego.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are in a position to be, to have developed some bodhicitta, you can then go and get more knowledge and get more practice that will also then reinforce your bodhicitta. So mm-hmm. it's sort of like a feeding the, your practice, but then the practice feeds back as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's an interrelationship which ultimately then leads you to to the better state, which is enlightenment.
Mm. And when it combines the great compassion with the understanding that, you know, nothing exists from its own side, it makes a very powerful, like I was explaining before, place of refuge, you know, where when your mind is that stable and that strong, it's like nothing can really penetrate it. You know, that's why in the text we have, it says, it's like the diamond, the sun, and the medicinal tree. And it's like the sun because it's the sun makes everything grow. So it's like the sun because, and also it just warms your heart, you know. Whenever you, you know that feeling when you really feel compassion, you just feel that warmth in your heart, and all the realizations of a bodhisattva grow from that place. It's like the sun. It's like a diamond because when you have it, when it's really strong, nothing can penetrate it. You know, that's how. I actually think the great. I keep going back to Christian examples, but I think the greatest example is the crucifixion. I mean, he had bodhicitta and nothing stopped. Nothing. There was no. Didn't bother him at all to be up there on that cross. You know, he was doing it for all sentient beings, and his bodhicitta was so strong that it was okay. You know. And that's the ideal, you know. That he was like Geshe Jampa Wangdu, you know, getting beaten up, you know. His only thing we ever heard was forgive them. You know, it's not like. So that's the aspiration, you know, to be like that. Because you can see by that example in Geshe Jampa Wangdu that anything can happen. And when that mind is so strong, nothing can disturb it. So it's like the greatest protection. And even at our baby stage, you know, if we can learn to use the turning around these situations, even now, I mean, we may not be able to do it right away, but you know, working with these different slogans and these different mind trainings, that anything that happens to you that would normally disturb you, over time, it might not happen in an instant, but over time, it will be transformed. It may take a little bit of work. You might have to think about it, you know, in some cases, maybe even for a year or so. But in the end, you know, with concerted effort, we can see all enemies and all bad conditions as our best friends. And then we have no enemies, you know. So it's very special practice. And before we get into it too much, and because we were talking about, because we haven't even gone into the text, but, oh, I forgot, and the last one, why it's like a medicinal tree, because it's the cure for all delusion, and actually the cure for all illness, because even, you know, I remember when a friend of mine was dying of cancer, and he said, healing isn't necessarily a cure. That healing is coming to the reconciliation with whatever the outcome is. And in his case, it was death. But he felt healed because even though there was no cure for his cancer, he was ready to die. You know. So I think that that's how it's the medicinal tree. It, in something that's not terminal, it does heal whatever rift, whatever reason you might hold a grudge for someone. There's no more grudges when you really can see that, you know, bad things, quote, bad things, can actually be blessings in disguise. And that's what we try to do, you know. And, yeah. So, and I just thought before we get into it too much more, because we were talking about perfect human rebirth, that I'd like to for us to share, if you would, you know, and I know it's a bit hard the first day, but different ways of overcoming that inappropriate self, what am I trying to say? That the kind of self-cherishing that appears to be humility, but is actually just like low self-esteem. You know, how do we get a healthy ego to start these practices? How do we heal? How do we really get that perfect human rebirth, which is the mind that's got the strength to go through these practices and understand them without twisting them, you know? So I'm just wondering in your own life if you've found different ways of, you know, healing yourself from issues that plague you, you know, that prevent you from being the greatest potential that you can be. It's like that poem that Henry Mandela? No. Nelson Mandela. I'm a bit tired too. I didn't sleep a lot last night. That Nelson Mandela said when he was freed, you know, or whenever he became president, whatever it was, that, you know, our greatest fear is being the great person that we are. You know, how do we keep ourselves down, and how do we remedy that without it being pride? You know, there's a healthy sense of I'm a good person without it being, you know, overly proud or underly, because that low self-esteem, in a way, I think of it as just, it's another form of pride. It's just reverse pride, you know. So does anybody have anything to share about how, just in their own lives, they may have dealt with that?
I think an area we can look at, and it certainly made a big difference to me, is looking at our close relationships. Mm-hmm. So family, very close friends. I have a particular relationship with my mother, where she knew exactly what buttons to hit, mm-hmm. if she wanted to get a reaction. Partly because she put them there in the first place. I can't remember where I read it, or where I heard it, I just don't recall. But the saying was, you know, treat that person as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'll try it. So in my mind, the next time she was doing that, it was actually over the phone, so it's a little bit safer.
Mm-hmm.
it made a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
It just changed the energy.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas before, if I saw her number come on the phone, part of me would say, oh, okay, what's it going to be this time?
Mm.
And of course, that still happens occasionally, because being a human being, we still make the same mistakes and the same perceptions. But it changed things hugely.
Mm.
And now she's starting, she's 19, and starting to lose her memory, and certain characteristics have always been there and now really come to the fore.
Mm.
Where in the past I would have reacted very impatiently and gone into a very defensive mode. Now I get 9 times out of 10 I can just sit even face to face and just accept what she was saying and not taking it personally. Or
how was she your teacher then?
It's really just changing that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Where the I, the self-cherishing bit, which is, you know, this is attacking me, therefore I've either got to attack back or run away or ridicule or whatever it is, or go and talk to somebody else and say how bad she was and this sort of thing. So it just changed that aspect quite a lot. And then interestingly, she picked up on it.
Mm-hmm.
So although she still tries it, she then tries a different set of buttons, which of course there was as well. And there was a recent event where she wanted to get her driving license back. And I'd be very open with her and said, I don't think she should have drive again. But she called me over, so I went over. I had an inkling what it was going to be. She wanted me to fill out the form to get back to DVLA.
Mm.
And I just said, look, if you feel capable of driving, then I think you should fill out the form. You can take your time, there's no rush. And I could tell she was very unhappy.
Mm.
Her whole face changed, everything.
Mm.
And then she basically had a temper tantrum and threw a stick across the lounge. So I calmly just went out and picked up the stick, put it by her side.
Wow, you're brave.
And I said, I'm really sorry that has upset you. But you being angry is not having that effect on me.
Mm.
And the sad thing is, it's having more an effect on you. And then you could see she thought about it, and then she did it again. I think on the idea, well, if I try it twice, it might work.
Yeah.
But again, I just didn't react. And then she said, oh, I think we should have a cup of tea.
Oh.
And that's her way of, in her mind, diffusing it.
Yeah.
She said, yes, let's go and have a cup of tea. So that is where it's made a difference to me.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah.
And then that's linked in to help with reducing my impatience. And it just has a ripple effect.
Mm. Yeah, I know for me when I was first trying to do these practices, and you bring up a really good point that you don't go off and tell somebody else about it. And like you can do it in the face of somebody else, but you're still holding this burning kind of grudge, and so you have to go tell somebody else, you know. I'll do that, you know. And and I remember in the beginning, and I would think, well, that's right, this person is my teacher, but he did this and this, this and this and this, you know. And finally, one day I realized there's no buts. It's just, it is what it is. There's no, you know, as long as you still are going, as long as I am, you know, it's not really being a teacher, is it? And it's taken me a long time to really catch all the little ways I twist myself out of really practicing, you know. Because self-cherishing is so, it's like a weasel, you know. It's just always, you know, like you said, it's just inside. You know, I always think of it, you know, like Lord of the Rings, it's like Gollum, you know. We all have a Gollum. And you know those discussions between Gollum and himself, you know. It's really, you know, like we do that, you know, we have to do that. We have to, like, negotiate with the self-cherishing mind, isn't it?
Remember that Tom and Jerry thing where he had the angel on one side and the devil on the other, the two shoulders, and they would argue, do it this way, no, do it that way.
Yeah.
Something
like that. Yeah. Anybody else? Shares?
I find if I'm having a tough time with sense of self, it's taken me a really long time to kind of develop a few strategies for that, and one of them is like a physical routine. So having like a discipline around getting out of bed and exercising and moving, and also putting a couple of things in place with two girlfriends of mine, so that if any one of the three of us are feeling quite low, then we can make like an emergency call to each other and just say, I'm feeling really low, can you check in on me a bit more this week?
Mm-hmm.
And we can do that for each other, and that's mm-hmm. been really helpful. It's just a little community,
mm-hmm.
but that sense of community really makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea. Mm. Mm. Does anybody struggle with those things? I mean, is it still an issue, or do you want to? I mean, I just think it's something that's good to think about and talk about, how we limit ourselves, you know, what kind of thoughts that limit ourselves, and you know, how strategies for looking at them, and you know, because I know there's more than what I know.
I could tell you what I find is that when you work very closely with people, there's maybe someone that you have an immediate aversion to, or they could totally irritate you, or whatever. It could be anybody. It doesn't have to be a relative, or it can be someone you work closely with. So, and I used to worry about that, because Rinpoche would not be happy mm. if you had those kind of thoughts, because when you work with him, you know mm-hmm. that it doesn't matter what. In the old days, the hippies used to throw tomatoes at him and everything, and he wouldn't just carry on teaching, you know. So I always think about Rinpoche, and then so what I decided to do was, from now on, when someone was completely making me crazy, it was only me, it's not them, they're just being themselves, I would find something about them that I could work with. Like, there's one guy that comes to Jamyang, and he used to drive me completely crazy. Well, he drives most people, but he's very funny, right? So I would click onto that humour of him. And now we go out for a curry, you know. And there's another one who he used to really rattle his mala when you're in a tree. Could hear it all over. I know that sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Rattling your mala, but if you're trying to count yours and he's clock, 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 and then you think, how can he be doing that so fast? Because it's got 100 syllables or whatever. And so I work with him as well, and of different things. He still does that with his mala, mind you. And you know, I got invited to his 80th birthday. It was a very special birthday. Yeah, so I think I wrote a thing on in my kitchen mm. over the kettle, and it says, what would Rinpoche say?
Mm-hmm.
Just in my own writing. Because mm-hmm. sometimes when I think, oh,
mm.
oh, what would Rinpoche say? Mm. Oh, yes. So it's good to pick on something mm. that's, because everybody has something. I'm not going to drive other people crazy, and if they did that with me, maybe.
Well, do you ever think that the things that, not maybe in this case, but sometimes the things that are most irritating to you and your family, your partner, are actually things that you yourself do.
Probably.
And it's just kind of a mirror.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think
you would. And no one can make you crazy unless you give them permission.
Mm.
Yeah, that's true. But when you grow up with it, that it becomes part of who you are, doesn't it? Mm. That's how you've been made to feel. Mm. Like you were saying, sometimes hard to deal with the mother.
Mm. Well, most definitely.
And then I watch my friends who do exactly the same thing with their children. It's just kind of sad, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Mm.
I had when my grandmother was dying, and she was dying for quite some time. Basically, she was bedridden for a long time. And she, And because before she actually sort of was reaching her end, she's been staying at home for I think over 7 years before that. So that really affected her mind, and it has become quite negative. And when she was in her last months, was coming to visit her regularly, I was trying to. She was very easily going into negative thoughts, and it was quite difficult to communicate with her. But I worked out that whenever she was referring to her past, she was quite joyful, and so I was trying to basically talk about past with her a lot, and ask her to remember what nice things she remembered or she liked, and that really made a difference to relationship and to basically, I think, hopefully to her well-being at that point as well. So how, at least how she communicated, that was one of the things that I think happens quite a lot, because people, when they're older, when they tend to remember very clearly some of their early age experiences, as opposed to maybe some of the recent experiences. So I think that actually really helps sometimes, is to put your mind into a positive state. At least by doing that, by remembering something positive. So.
Well, what kind of things do we do when it's ourselves that's the problem? That's kind of what I'm looking for. Like, what do you do? I mean, you said you have some friends, but if there's other things that, you know, when you encounter the kinds of things, like just taking a moment to think about what thoughts, what kinds of things you tell yourself that you feel about yourself that limit your ability to care for others or care for yourself, or, you know, if you've ever even thought about that before.
Yeah, and part of my approach to therapy is that the conversations that we have don't describe reality, they construct it. So if the conversation, you're the person you have most conversations with, so if the conversation you're having is, "You idiot, why did you do that? What on earth were you thinking of?" etc. That's the reality you're going to create. So part of it is, "Oh, hang on, how can I acknowledge that event in a way that's more affirmative to me?"
For a long time, I, to have like a big reset, had to stop like listening to the voices, like that kind of self-talk. But I couldn't replace it with something else more positive. So I started doing things like, I could never be alone in my head, so I'd listen to a lot of podcasts, or the radio, and like I was aware that it was an avoidance, but it kind of like I needed like a good chunk of time out from my mind. So that was one strategy I had.
That's a good strategy.
So long as I was aware it was needed to be temporary, it felt. And another strategy a friend of mine told me about was years ago, was after like a really troubled relationship, to be able to say to myself, "Stop," like out loud, if I was having thoughts that were really negative and kind of self-destructive. It's just to really verbalize, "Stop," as almost like a reset or a way to pause those thoughts. Yeah. Just like super little practical kind of ways of managing those kinds of things.
Yeah, because I think for me, you know, self-cherishing is really sneaky. And those kinds of putting yourself down, you know, "I wish I should have done that," or "Why didn't you do that?" or "You could have been so much better if you'd done that," and this, that, the other. It's that kind of self-chastising is actually a form of self-cherishing. You know, it's not really helpful, and that's what you're saying. And I think in my own case, it's like, well, you did the best you could, you know, it's good enough. You know, why keep hashing over, "Why didn't you do this?" and "You should have done that," and, you know, and I know that I haven't mentioned it yet, but one of the things that's really important in these meditations that we do is just what you're saying, is paying attention to the type of voice, you know, because there's a controller inside that's saying, you know, "Now your mind's wandering, let's bring it back," you know. And to pay attention to the feeling tone of that voice. Is it, you know, a chastising mom or a mean school teacher, or is it like your best friend who loves you and saying, come on now, you can come back and pay attention to what the meditation is. And it's important to make that inner environment a friendly place where you know that if you go there and the voices in the head will be kind voices, you know. Because we can't really even begin to be that way with other people if we can't have acceptance for what who we are, isn't it? So I think it's kind of our first job is to, and it goes all, you know, throughout the whole years and years of practice is how am I speaking to myself, isn't it? Yeah.
And for me, it's also about being more tuned into what other people are saying as well. I'm thinking, I work in a professional context where it's very easy to, a community development work, it's very easy to be self-effacing, so it can marry up really nicely with, you know, some of that low self-esteem stuff. But also people I work with can often be the greatest teacher around that of like, no, it's really me to you, you know, completely. It's a kind of doing things together and in partnership. And so it's about, I've started to develop an awareness of kind of that, those messages I'm giving myself, but then actually just having awareness of that, but being able to really deeply listen to what other people are saying. And then perhaps when I've got the, you know, my own negative or critical stuff happening, just putting a stop on it, or, you know, changing the dialogue a bit internally to other points of view.
Yeah, and see yourself how other people see you, maybe, rather than your inner critic, you know.
Yeah, and I think the way other people see you, you know, they can also be exaggerating their positive qualities, but often it'll just be quite a neutral way, or a positive way, and you know, it's just recognizing the good qualities you've brought to an interaction, something positive you've done.
Yeah, to have that kind of confidence that we can do this.
I think the other aspect is, which I found very useful, is being an observer of what is going on in our mind rather than being engaged and also trying to change. And by observing, I mean, I use humour a lot within my mind. So it's not being judgmental. It's a lighter energy, and that can diffuse lots of things. Because you're not saying you've done something wrong. It's just that was a funny thing you did. And then because you're the observer, then you can maybe later on ask the question, could I have done something just slightly different in the approach? Also, I get... I put things off. I'm terrible. It's like an art form with me sometimes. I procrastinate. And the number of times I get to finally do something, and in my mind I've built up, this is going to take so much effort and work, and it then takes 10 minutes. Yeah. And again, rather than beating myself up, I use the humour and the observation to say, well, maybe next time you can reflect on how you're observing it now, and very slowly, tiny steps at a time, you can change it. And also just taking one deep breath. A number of times I've felt, you know, a little bit of tension building up, whatever it might be, and just mentally taking a step back and a deep breath has made a huge difference. Again, it just changes that. Sometimes.
I think it was Pema Chodron, or I'm not sure who it was, says that anger can be diffused in 90 seconds. If you can, you know, they've done studies. If you can just hold off for 90 seconds and just breathe, then you can let it pass, you know.
And picking up on the Qigong and the meridians, if as you breathe, you use a flat hand across the chest, breath, you'll find that really brings the tension down.
Mm.
So breathe in.
Maybe that's why people pat babies on the back. Yeah. It's a similar thing when babies are crying. Yeah. You know.
Or intuitively people do this under tension. Mm-hmm. Or, and again, it's using meridians.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I'll try that in the middle of Waitrose next time.
Often people do it without realising.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've seen somebody on stage walking around and giving a presentation and doing that, and his only conversation afterwards that, you know, kind of pointed out what he was doing and he had no idea at all. Mm.
No, thank you. I didn't know about that. So.
Mm. Yeah, maybe when we sit down to bed, there's this whole tapping that you can do to fuse.
That's part of it.
Yeah, it's the last
EFT.
One is, yeah.
That's EFT.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've tried a little bit of that over the last couple of months, and it's been really helpful.
Mm.
Yeah. For anxiety.
Yeah, or any time an emotional thing comes up. Mm. Yeah. We can do it now if you want. We have time. You just, it'd be interesting to see how you know it, but the way I didn't really learn his EFT. I actually just heard this on a radio show one time. Someone was saying that, you know, it's like rescue remedy. You know, if you're in a state of emotion, you just tap your eyebrows. And I find it's one way of settling my mind at the beginning of meditation. You know, you tap your eyebrows. And then you tap under here. We'll try it when we go in. It settles the mind, you know. And then you tap here. To relax the jaw. And then here. And here. And here.
In a bit.
Yeah, here. Yeah. And then here. How do you know?
Okay, I know it as EFT, which was
emotional freedom technique.
Emotional freedom technique.
Yeah.
Emotional feeling.
Freedom.
Emotional freedom.
Freedom
technique.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm an accredited advanced practitioner.
Oh, what's all this then?
Yeah. And also company secretary of the leading professional body. Mm. I have a vested interest.
Oh, that's good. No, I read the book
yeah.
years back.
I use the app.
Yeah. Oh, there's an app, huh?
Yeah.
And it's one of the things about it is that it's incredibly easy to learn, and deceptively so, because it can get to considerable depths. And if you're on your own, you haven't got enough sort of support around, that can be...
Can somebody with a learning disability learn to do that? Yeah. Something like that, do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I have a daughter, she's in her 30s, and she has a learning disability and she's autism.
Oh,
and
wow.
She does terrible self-injury to herself when she gets upset about things. Mm. She's hit herself in the face with a glass before, and she regularly bruises her face. She has cuts down here. She's got a permanent scar on the back of one hand, where since her sort of early teen years, she just bites the back of her hand, and it's just, you know, a real sort of bad scar just there. So, and it's very difficult to teach her to do anything to help her. She just immediately flies off the handle and does these things. And then she's always, I'm sorry afterwards, or the damage has been done, you know, she's hurt herself. But it's how to kind of teach, because she doesn't really engage with therapy. It's been tried, but she just kind of sits there and doesn't engage. Mm. She's not greatly, she hasn't got great language ability, although she can understand more than she can. Speak, so it'd be interesting.
I've used it with people on autistic spectrum.
Oh, right, okay. Well, that's really interesting.
And I've got some colleagues who specialise in working with autistic.
Right, okay. Mm. I might have a chat with you sometime.
Yeah, chat with them.
Yeah,
later.
Certainly, that would be great.
Yeah. But yeah, in terms of the point, there's lots of variations. The standard traditional approach is tune into tune into the negative problem. So even though I've got this, whatever, or even though I feel whatever, I completely and unconditionally love and accept myself. So tune into the negative and put a positive twist on it. And in terms of kind of illustration, I see it as the negative emotion is caused by a past event of some kind, and that's stuck in the energy field.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's stuck there, it can't shift. When you put a positive twist to it, that neutralizes it. So it loosens its grip, mm-hmm. and then you put energy into the system and it kind of washes it away.
I found it really helpful. It sort of just I was really struggling with changing the way I was thinking about certain things, and just having a physical manifestation felt like I was able to do something really practical towards it.
Mm-hmm. It is, and it basically, and there's a lot of research coming out now, and we know that it rewires the brain. Basically, there's anxiety fundamentally comes from a perception of threat, which is triggers the amygdala, and the amygdala then and again we've got magnetic resonance imaging now, which shows that tapping actually sends a calm signal to the amygdala.
So does it matter where you tap?
It's a very forgiving system.
Mm-hmm.
The exact points are there, which you did with start of the eyebrow, and if I do it, I always do
alternately.
As far as I know, I'm the only one I know who does that, and I do that because there's another therapeutic approach to trauma called EMDR.
Yeah, I know that one too.
Yeah, well the therapeutic component of EMDR is thought to be the alternate side stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, if you've got bilateral points, you might as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. There's no research that says whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, but that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's start of the eyebrow, side of the eye, under the eye, under the nose, on the chin, just under the collarbone. So where you've got the
U-shaped
notch, sternal notch, there's an oblique bit either side.
Mm-hmm.
Just under there, there's a wee bit of a depression, and it's there. So there, under the arm, it's kind of in the middle of the bra strap, if you're wearing one, which I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
One which is useful for men, it's a bit more awkward for women because it's where the skin of the breast meets the skin of the chest. So, yeah, it's kind of there, so you have to move bits out of the way. So, I don't, but you might have to. Yeah.
Can be quite discreet as well.
So it can be,
If I was on the bus, I wouldn't feel like I was being looked at. I could just do something quite quietly.
That's right. Yeah, and the finger ends as well, so you can, you know, you might look like a bit of a nervous tic, but you've got points there as well. So it's on the outside edge, where the, at the base of the nail. Yeah.
And so you could use that as like a self-therapy too, isn't it? You can bring up things that need to be let go of and...
Yeah.
Concentrate on that, and I knew another who did
it. But whenever an emotion arises, just try it. And just about 6 or 7 times on each spot. You'll sometimes see people doing the top of the head as well.
Yeah, so try it sometime.
Yeah, it's just like distraction, isn't it?
It's more than that.
It's more than
that. Yeah, the points you use are the end points of each of the meridians. So when I tap on there, and
that's the gallbladder meridian.
Thank you. You're putting a kind of shockwave of energy going round, or tidal waves better.
All through the gallbladder.
That's the liver.
This Chinese medicine. This is kidney meridian. This is stomach meridian. This is the large intestine meridian. Yeah. So you're just touching. It's like qigong, but you're touching all the meridians, and something about that. Then reprograms the experience in the brain.
There's a really good book by an Orthodox medic who's also an acupuncturist called Spark in the Machine, and he comes up with the hypothesis of what actually happens, and he suggests that it's a piezoelectric effect. Yeah, do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
So, yeah, you do. You know the gaslighters you have where you just press the button in and there's a spark?
Sure.
That's piezoelectric. It's a quartz crystal. And when you compress a quartz crystal, it gives out a bit of electricity. And there's a suggestion that actually tapping on those points, mm-hmm. it's right where the fascia comes over, and you get the piezoelectric effect. So you get a little shockwave of mm-hmm. electricity, and we are creatures of electricity.
Mm.
Again, we need more research. The whole approach has only been around about 30 years. It was developed originally by a South African called Roger Callahan, who'd been working with a woman with water phobia for about 2 years and hadn't got anywhere.
Mm.
And he'd also been studying Chinese medicine. And one day she said the magic words about when she got this phobia, and it was so bad that she could get into a bath of water with that much water in after 2 years of therapy. And she said how sick she felt in the stomach. And he said, well, okay, I think it was this one that he used. And he said, try tapping on there, because that's in Chinese medicine, that's connected to the stomach, and see what happens, see if it settles the sickness. And she, by 30 seconds, it's gone. What's gone? The sickness. No, the fear. And she ran off and jumped in his swimming pool.
Wow, that's a great story.
Yeah. And he then thought, this is interesting, and kind of wrote it up as a case study from then on. And developed an incredibly complex approach with all sorts of algorithms to find out the right point to tap on.
Mm.
And one of his students was an engineer, and engineers make things simpler and more efficient. So he took the complex algorithms and made it into EFT.
Mm.
Greatly upset the originator, but not the rest of the world.
Mm. Maybe I wonder if your daughter
It sounds amazing, because she gets so anxious about some things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like she's terribly anxious about her washing. Doing her washing, so to avoid the anxiety, she doesn't do any washing, and then she's got piles and piles of it, and no clothes to wear. So it's, well, let's do some washing. Then no, and we have to count everything, because a few years ago some things went missing, and that just was so terrible for her, the things of hers to go missing. It's that grasping, you know, it's so intense in her to see. The grasping of the things, and I can't let go of it, and I can't let anybody else touch it, and somebody might take it, and they might steal it, and I might not get it back, and that's what the anxiety is all about. So to avoid the anxiety, she avoids doing the activity that will lead to the anxiety.
Well, I think it's just an extreme case of how we all are, actually.
Yeah, it actually is, and you can. It's really. I very often think this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
terrified of losing things. I mean,
when we
went on a holiday a little while back, and going through security is just an absolute nightmare, because you have to let go of your stuff. You have to let go of your stuff, and you have to let it go through this thing, and it might not come out the other end. She knows that things sometimes get taken away from people, which they sometimes do. So having a conversation with her beforehand, saying, no, they're not going to take it away. But they took Granddad's penknife away, and they put it in the glass box. That was 20 years ago or 15 years ago. But she never would forget that.
Yeah.
But they took Granddad's penknife, and he never got it back. So how do I know they're not going to take my iPad, and I'll never get it back? Well, you can't actually fight with that logic, because... It could actually happen.
They took my wife's embroidery scissors.
Well, there you go. And
that's one of the tiny little things to cutting the silks.
Yeah.
The event. She forgot about them.
So that moment when you have to let go of the things and then have the faith that you will get them back at the end is just sort of the anxiety. And if one thing happens, like they might say to her, can you take your shoes off? That's it. She's lost it. She took them off once. They said to her, take them off. She went, right. She sat down, she took her shoes off, and she hurled them at the barrier thing. She literally took them off and hurled them at it.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Oh, so it's the sort of what you'd all like to do. But she actually has...
She doesn't find the
ambition. Does it? No, she doesn't.
Well, how does that affect you then? It must be make your own life difficult.
It's... I do feel terribly anxious before, and I do feel really kind of grateful afterwards when it all goes through. But it's really frightening when it happens, because that time when she did that, I thought, we were in Canada. We were coming home from Canada. And I thought they weren't going to, I thought, well, they're not going to let us on the flight. How are we going to get home? How are we going to get home from Canada? They're not going to let us on the flight. Luckily, my husband went and talked to somebody and explained it all. And she calmed down, although it took a long time. Yeah, it's
quite helpful to keep you calm yourself, because she'll pick up on your...
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, since I've been studying Buddhism, I think I'm better at it. I mean, it used to be, well, we both get in a state, you know. She'd go off and I'd go, oh, for goodness sake, you know. But I know now that I have to keep really, really calm. And if I can keep calm, then it's much easier.
That's not easy.
If we both lose it, well... You've really had it, you know.
I pity your husband.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing as well, is that between the two of us, we have to kind of bat it backwards and forwards between us.
Yeah.
If one of us, if I can see that he's losing it, then I'll say, okay, let me take over. And if he sees I'm losing it and I really kind of can't hold it together anymore, then he'll say to me, oh, let me deal with it, you know.
Wow.
So we have to help each other out with it a lot.
What a life.
Yeah. Well, she doesn't live with us, but it feels like she does.
Yeah.
Because we're always having to step in to solve problems.
Does she live in a home?
She's got her own flat, would you believe? Yeah. But a very high level of support. I mean, a lot of things she can, her own sort of personal care, she can do herself. And a lot of housework, she just won't do it. So we come in every now and then and sort of do things that you just can't leave any longer, you know. It's the same with the washing, it's the anxiety. But she has a PA, a personal assistant, who comes and works with her every day. She has Monday to Saturday care, and she comes to us on a Sunday. Yeah. But
maybe this could be really helpful. There's an app, right? Is it just the EFT app? Is that what it's called?
I'll have a look on my phone when I turn it back on.
Yeah.
I'll be turning it back on to check. And I'll let you know what it is.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
It's really helpful.
Yeah, maybe everyone would like to know, because we all have those moments. Yeah, everyone has them. And I think if you're decided to do some kind of retreat when you're by yourself, sometimes even more of that stuff comes up. So it's good to have a technique of how to release and let go. Yeah.
You can actually give you the confidence to allow it just to arise.
Yeah, so if you knew that you had some way of letting go of that fear, then you could let it come up, maybe.
Which is huge.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Because we always want to suppress those sort of thoughts.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Carl. So, we haven't really gotten into the text much to have anything to discuss, but and I'm wondering if it might be nice. Do we want to read it all together, or before we start, maybe at the beginning of the next session, read the whole text, and then we'll go through it step by step, and we'll start with the preliminaries the next time we get together. We already did talk about the perfect human rebirth. So I thought one of the ways I'll get through it is some of the stuff we'll talk about, but some of it maybe we'll catch in the meditations. So, and I just thought that it's good to... The perfect human rebirth is a very positive thing. It's a thing about feeling, you know, gratitude and rejoicing that we have one, you know, and it's also meant to inspire us to use it, you know, because what I didn't talk about in one of the teachings talk about is how rare it is to have a perfect human rebirth. I don't know how many of you have studied the Lam Rim, but, you know, they say that there's the classic thing about the turtle, the golden yolk, and the turtle there's a golden yolk, you know, that's floating in the ocean, and a turtle that comes up to the surface every 100 years. And the chance of that turtle entering into the yolk every 100 years is floating on the ocean. It's how rare it is to have a human rebirth where we have all the conditions to practice Dharma. And the causes for having a perfect human rebirth are just so many multitudes of gathering of virtuous activity. And they say that, you know, we have, you know, millions of lives is in other lives, but this is our one opportunity. And so the point is to inspire us not to waste our time. And it doesn't mean that we all have to go off and get ordained and go into retreat. What it means is that we need to do the most that we can to make the most out of every moment of our breathing life to create the causes for enlightenment. And that's what this helps. This is very helpful for that. And the heart of this practice is this. Excuse me. I didn't sleep so much last night. Is the taking and giving, the Tonglen practice that we did a little bit this morning. Are you breathing in the suffering of others and breathing out the healing for others? So you're taking on the suffering and giving out the healing, and taking on the self-cherishing and giving out the caring for others, and taking on the ignorance and giving out the wisdom. And I think today we just started with ourselves, but you do a little bit with yourself and a little bit for others. And they say that Lama Tsongkhapa, who was the author of many of the texts we have and inspired this whole lineage that we have, that they say that he was so well trained that his every breath was Tonglen, which is amazing, isn't it, to think of that? You know. So these kinds of things, then it's good to train in the morning doing some Tonglen, you know, because then you remember it. And one of the reasons it's so helpful is that it's a breathing exercise, and we're always breathing. And when we spend a bit of time in the morning time just breathing and being aware of our breath and being aware of what's going on in our mind when we breathe, and doing what we can to mount this experience of taking on suffering and giving out healing first for ourselves and others, is that we're always breathing. And so if we get in the habit of doing it, say 15 minutes in the morning, then when we have a little pause, like Lama Zopa says, take advantage of every pause, you know, the stop sign, the red light, standing in line at the grocery store, waiting in the elevator, when you're walking down the street, you know, all the times when you're not busy, if we practice Tonglen, practice remembering, you know, being aware of our breathing, then we can be practicing, we can be going back to our practice throughout the day, you know, to the point where we're always breathing and we kind of always are tuning into it, so that all you have to do, and if you create that space inside that's like that safe, warm place where you feel calm from doing Tonglen, then all you have to do is remember your breath and you can go back to that place. And it may take a bit of EMDR if it's EFT if it's a particularly stressful moment. But if it's just a normal moment and you're, you know, just in the middle of just doing your normal thing, you can make it unnormal by breathing and remembering, oh, that's right, I have refuge in my heart. I remember the Buddhas, you know, I remember my motivation. And so that's why a breathing meditation is such a helpful aid to transforming our lives. Oh my goodness. So maybe we should take a break unless someone wants to say something else. Sharing about dealing with how we, because a lot of people haven't said anything about our how we deal with the way we talk to ourselves and the way we see ourselves. And I think it's really important to just do a survey, you know, about what is our particular tapestry of how we view the world, you know? Is it one of poor me or what is it, you know, how is it? And because I guess the goal is to understand that we create our reality, isn't it? And we have the choice. So does anyone else want to share? Do you want to say something, Ola?
Yeah, I have two things actually. One, just a quick on the
on this back of the story with my grandmother, actually to add that it wasn't only helpful, I think, for my grandmother, it was helpful for me, because having dealing with a person who is in a very negative state of mind all the time is quite difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And actually when I ask her to talk about something nice, it also gives me an opportunity to engage with her in a more constructive way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think even if it's, you know, even for yourself, trying to talk or to engage on something positive with someone who is, and try to switch someone in a negative state of mind is really helpful for you
mm-hmm.
as well, to manage
mm-hmm.
your reaction
mm-hmm.
to this person. And the other thing that I wanted to say is actually one of the things that I do, I recently put up a sticker of in my room, which on which you can write in a marker and then erase.
Mm-hmm.
And basically I put things, like I put expressions or thoughts on this sort of wall that I know that I need to, that I want to work on
mm-hmm.
At that particular moment. And so, for example, or if I need to remind myself at that point that I feel it's a really, you know, the reminder that I need to just practice and internalize a little bit more. So, like, for example, if I feel that I'm getting into isolation mode more, I'll put, like, engage with others or engage with the world or something
mm-hmm.
like that, and I will stick around for, like, several days until I kind of, and it's in front of me when I wake up, so
mm-hmm.
it's in my bedroom, and as soon as I wake up, it's just there, and
mm-hmm.
it kind of, it reminds me straight away. And so I find it's really helpful, because
mm-hmm.
then you can erase, and if something important, something else important happens in your life, and then you think, okay, that's a really great thought or
mm-hmm.
something that I want to internalize, then you put it there
mm-hmm.
as well, and you just, like, it's there for whatever time you need it. And then you change it again if you need to, and when you add other
mm-hmm.
things as well.
Well, that's exactly what this is. When we get
mm-hmm.
towards the end, there's these different slogans, you know, that you use, and you can, and Pema Chodron, and I saw someone has Trungpa's book, they really emphasize this a lot in their sangha, and she has a set of flashcards that comes, and I did this last summer with some people in Reno, and they all bought the flashcards, and they would come with a little stand, and they're all the, each one of these verses is one. And what she suggests is you put one up and you work with that for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put the next one up and you work with that for a week.
Mm-hmm.
Just exactly what you're doing. So you probably have some puzz, you know. And it is really helpful, because then you learn the slogans. And once you've learned them all, then they're very helpful. So when the appropriate situation comes up, you can remember, oh, right, I need to... You know, don't turn a god into a demon is one of them. Is like, or don't, you know, don't, these different ones. And so I forgot to mention that, but you can probably buy them here too. You know, it's like $20 for a little box of these cards. And it's not exactly the same words, but it means the same thing. And I found that, I mean, I don't have them myself, but the woman I was staying with got them. And that time when I was there, it was really nice to use them. And it would be this, and you could just write them. You don't have to get the cards, you know. You could just pick one, you know, and write them up there, you know. I remember one time I was going through a hard time, and I went into a grocery store, and they had something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And behind, I think it was the meat counter, you know, they had, instead of, like, you know,
mm-hmm.
lamb 25 something, it was this thing that said, or maybe it was behind the coffee counter, but it was forgiveness is letting go of wishing you had a better past. And I thought that was a nice thing.
Some of the tube stations up in London.
They
have like a, you know, one of those boards but that you can wipe off.
Yeah.
And they have those kind of things written on as you go past.
Yeah.
As you go into the tube, they're really good.
Yeah, it's very inspiring.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
I notice forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like that prayer of the Dalai Lama's that they've got in the dining room as well. you know, every day when you wake up, that one. I used to use that quite a lot when I was working and it was really getting stressful.
Yeah.
I used to use it to start the day.
Yeah, no, this is this is my opportunity to use my perfect human rebirth and devote my life to others, you know.
That's the one. Yeah.
And it is important first thing in the morning to wake up. And I remember Rigpa Rinpoche used to say, first thing in the morning, grab a hold of your mind.
Mm.
You know, just take hold of your mind and feed the information you want to have that day, which the Dalai Lama says good. Just remembering your bodhicitta motivation when you first wake up, you know, is really, really, really helpful. You know, and I find gratitude a really nice way to wake up in the morning, just being grateful to have a perfect human rebirth and have met the Dharma and all my friends and...
Or to be alive.
Just to be alive.
Another day. Thanks
to
the Dharma.
Yeah, still here. We didn't die yet, you know. Yeah. So, you want to say something to you? Nothing to say? Okay, well then, let's just have a dedication then, and as we get into it, we'll have more to talk about. But the next bit we need to talk about are the... well, I'll read the first bit, the first paragraph, but then it says, first, learn the preliminaries. And it could be, you know, the whole Lamrim, but in this case, it's the main, what they call Nikagyu, the four uncommon preliminaries, and it's the perfect human rebirth, the fact that you're going to die, and and understanding karma. Because understanding karma is the crux of all this, because we can't transform it around if we don't understand that it's just karma ripening, you know. And the main thing is to think that I can't experience anything unless I created the cause. So if you realize that you created the cause to experience this, without thinking I'm bad, you know, it's just out of ignorance I created this cause, so then that in itself will immediately stop you blaming anybody for doing anything, because you created the cause for it. They just happen to be the agent that's allowing that karma to ripen for you.
It's like Ho'oponopono.
Is that like that too?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a Hawaiian therapy.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I'm sorry, forgive me, I love you.
Yeah.
In simplest form.
Yeah. So, that's all, I mean, this is just another one of those many forms, you know, but they say in the teachings on patience, you know, if somebody hits you with a stick, you know, you don't get angry at the stick, you know. So if someone is angry at you, you don't get angry at the person. It's the anger. It's their delusions, you know. You can still love the person and just understand that they're under the influence of delusion at the time. And it's your past delusions that have caused them to act in the way that they are. So if we realize that we really have to think about this one, because we may talk about it, but when the push comes to shove and we're in that situation, the tendency to think that someone else did this to me is so easy to go into that, particularly in the heat of a, you know, you just the tit for tat thing, you get into an argument, you know, instead of just stopping immediately and going, right, here we go again, you know, let's just diffuse this, like, let's go have a cup of tea, you know, let's talk about this another time. So it's really, really important to understand karma and that nothing comes without the creating the cause, and nothing goes away without purification. So that's where the idea of doing purification practices is that then we can purify seeds of karma on our mind streams before they ripen, or at least lessen their effect, you know. So, and then the fourth one is suffering, and we'll go into that later. But let's take a half an hour break, and we'll meet back at 4:45.
May I ask?
Yeah, you can ask anything.
I think that you might have mentioned this either last night or early this morning, but something that I've been thinking about a lot today is how easy it is. I'm more inclined to think, if, say, for the example, someone was angry at me, I'm more inclined to think, okay, what did I do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right, I've definitely done something. And it's so easy to swing into shame around that and to take all the responsibility for it. It's just something I've been thinking about, is how to counteract going too far one way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any answers for it. Mm. But I just wanted to kind of represent that again.
Well, does anyone want to respond to that? How it is you don't take it on and think it's all my fault, I did it? No?
I think it's very common that we do it, maybe particularly as women, maybe.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well,
saying
I think...
That,
men might
yeah.
Have
yeah.
I mean, to me, when someone is angry, I wouldn't have looked at this in the past, but I have a slightly different approach, is that just because they're angry at me does not mean I caused the anger. The anger could have been caused by something that happened many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that these particular circumstances have effectively ripened,
mm-hmm.
and they haven't taken the choice
mm-hmm.
to not be angry.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there are certain circumstances where you do need to look after yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So if the anger is escalating, because then it can become violence,
mm.
then you have to move away. But otherwise, it is just an acceptance that we've all been through this.
Mm-hmm.
We've all had our own moments of intense anger,
mm.
frustration, you know, in all sorts of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a shared
mm-hmm.
thing, not I'm unique, that
mm-hmm.
person's being angry at me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sort of helps diffuse things a little bit.
Mm.
But I think responsibility in the Buddhist concept is very important. As you say, it's very important not to take everything as your responsibility.
Mm.
Well, to stop it from turning into shame. Mm-hmm.
Indeed, because then it becomes judgment,
and
self-judgment.
That really sort of slippery bit that I find difficult
mm-hmm.
is it can so easily go into shame,
mm.
which becomes much harder to look at.
I think to me it's about trying to maintain that distinction, which can seem subtle at times, about I'm not my actions, I'm not my thoughts, mm-hmm. you know, I might do something out of ignorance or anger or something, but as we all do, but that doesn't make me a bad person, you know, so trying to maintain that, because if it was someone else, you know, even though I might be angry at someone, or, you know, if they've done something, acted out of ignorance or aversion or something like that, you know.
You probably give them the benefit of the
doubt. Yeah, well, you see that that's not who they are underneath,
mm.
so if you can then apply that lens back to yourself.
Mm.
You're not doing what's called cognitive fusion sometimes, but it's, you're not making sort of yourself equal to what you're thinking.
I think more and more with meditation, the more you can distance your thoughts from who you are, you know, like what she's saying, I'm not my thoughts, you know, and really understanding karma, because I notice being around Lama Zofimche a lot, he never takes anything personally, you know, it's just, for him, it's just karma ripening, you know, I've never seen him feel bad when things don't go the way he wanted them to. He'll just go, there's no karma, you know, or if something happens, if someone's angry at you, you know, it's just it was just karma, you know, instead of, in a way, you know, shame is that, it's a form of self-cherishing in a way, it's about self, Rob Priest doesn't use the translation self-cherishing, he calls it self-preoccupation. Which is, what is the word you just used?
Oh, cognitive fusion.
Yeah, I think that's the same thing.
Yeah,
absolutely. Is fusing an event with, this is about me. It's not about you, it's just about an event. So probably something would be helpful would just be more meditation on emptiness, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that there's nothing here to grasp onto, to feel bad about, you know? And that it isn't me at all. It's just something happened. There's a very good book that's been around for a long time, and maybe Carl knows more about more modern ones, but it's written by a Jungian. His name is John Bradshaw. He was very popular in the 80s, and it's a book called Healing the Shame That Binds You. And I'm sure you can still get it. Probably on Amazon for $2 or something, you know, because I read that in the early 90s, and it helped me a lot. with letting go of that. So you might want to get it, you know, because it's nice to think, if I could meditate on emptiness and karma, I could heal these things. But sometimes we need intermediary steps, and so psychological things are helpful, you know. But a lot of it is just, you know, that we really need to learn to love ourselves just as we are, you know. You know, just, I'm good enough. Lamia used to say that all the time. You're good enough. It's good enough, dear. That we don't need to be perfect, you know. We all are like that when things go wrong. You know, I could have done this. I should have done that. It's all my fault. Why didn't I do this? I mean, who hasn't gone round and round and round like that? Until, for me, I'll finally realize, that's self-cherishing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think part of what it is, it's self-cherishing comes in so many, or self-preoccupation comes in so many different forms that we don't recognize that that is actually what we, you know, that's the only enemy is that, you know. So I think whenever we're going through obsessive thoughts, there's usually an element of self-cherishing in there, you know, some kind of self-preoccupation that if we can just flick the switch, you know, and probably the EFT is the switch. That's what I like about it. It flicks the switch so that when you're stuck in a narrative of ah, la 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 la, you know, you do that and I think what happens is I read another book once about trauma, and they said that, you know, what happens is you get triggered by something that happened in the past, and you go back into your reptile brain, and that's where you can't get out. And it's the trigger, it's the amygdala that somehow has some control over that. Because when you're in your frontal lobes, you can have, that's where compassion is, that's where reason is, that's where you can let go of that stuff. So when you're back there, it's like you've been, and that's another technique of, you just imagine you're just massaging your amygdala and imagine that the energy, instead of in the back of your head, is in the front of your head. And they've done studies, just listening to music that you love, mm-hmm. brings the energy into your frontal lobes, which is why we love music so much. And why I like to chant the tunes, because then it's music. And we're all ready before we sit down to meditate, because we've been chanting and singing a little bit. You know, we're already moving into our more compassionate brain. You know? So.
But then the problem is when the amygdala is triggered, the amygdala gets a heads up whenever there's anything which fires off the adrenal glands. So basically, any threat, the amygdala notices what's happening and then spends the rest of its life looking for things which broadly match the pattern. Mm. And it doesn't have to be a very close match. You know, and the best analogy I've come up with is, imagine you're driving along a road at night, and as you go around a bend, there's some lights, and then bang, there's a crash. Thereafter, any sudden flash of light is likely to trigger the same reaction that you got with the crash. Okay, and you can't logic yourself out of it, because as soon as the amygdala kicks in and the adrenals kick in,
yeah, you start.
The frontal cortex goes offline, mm-hmm. and you run purely from the primitive brain. Yeah, that's why if you see a couple of, I think you were saying about something escalating and getting towards a fight. If you're in the outside the pub on a Friday night and there's a couple of guys squaring up ready to fight, the closer they get to throwing the first punch, the more monosyllabic they become, and they lose the ability to string a sentence together.
Oh.
And it's quite interesting to watch.
That's interesting, because my daughter, when she gets, I mean, she has difficulty with her speech anyway, but when she gets really stressed out, she says, my words got stuck.
Yeah.
My words are stuck.
And that's because
and that she just can't say it. She can't communicate at all.
Because the prefrontal cortex has gone offline.
Yeah.
Mm. And the reptilian brain doesn't have words.
Yeah.
It just reacts.
Mm. Yeah, and that's what she does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is why when someone's angry at you, to try to reason with them, it's just
impossible. You can't.
And I mean, how many times have we tried to reason with someone when they're angry with us?
And they get even more angry.
And they get even more angry. The best. Yeah. This is why the teaching on offering the victory. You're right, dear. Thank you so much. Let's talk about it another time. Because then, if you can go back to the issue later, then you can talk about it. But you know what used to happen for me is that I would get hooked, which meant I was actually angry too. Mm. I might not have been shouting or acting angry, but the fact that I could get sucked into having an argument with somebody is because I've lost it as well. Mm. Because we trigger each other, you know. Somebody triggers, you know, you say something triggers that person, and they know how to trigger you, and pretty soon you're lost in escalation of some kind of argument, you know. And so it, and that's the danger, is that once you're stuck in it, it's really hard to get out of it, unless one of them, you know, two people has enough to realize, oh, you know, I'm going to walk away, or I'm going to tap, or I'm going to do something, you know, to. But it's the same with what you're talking about, because that is being angry at yourself. And so immediately you get stuck back in this reptile brain. So the thing to do is do something that brings you forward. Listen to some music, you know, tap, you know. Yeah. So what we've been learning in psychology in the last 20, 30 years is really, really helpful.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's Buddha. I mean, a lot of the psychologists are Buddhists now too, you know, people doing this.
There is a Buddhist foundation psychotherapy,
yeah,
called Process, started by Frank and Maura Mills.
Seals.
Oh?
Sills.
That's the one? Yeah.
Is that the one that's in the Western England?
Yeah. Think so.
Yeah, there's a place I know you can go and
down in Devon.
Yeah,
I've heard about that.
Yeah, I did that training.
Oh, you did that training? Was it good?
Yeah.
Can you just say the name of the book that you said before?
It's called Healing the Shame That Binds You.
I think that's the subtitle. I think the title is Homecoming.
No, there's two different books.
There's three or four.
Yeah, but one of them is Homecoming,
yeah,
and one of them is Healing the Shame That Binds You. Unless he's republished them together, I don't know. Because Homecoming is a different book. And when I was in my first long retreat, I used his work a lot. It helped me. And Homecoming is different because it goes through the different... I've given it to other younger people who are like starting on the Buddhist path. And it goes through the different cognitive development stages, not quite like Piaget, but sort of like what you need as like your emotional food when you're like an infant, when you're 3, and when you're 5, and when you're 10, and when you're, and the kinds of things that you needed to hear. And so what he used to do in group therapy, because he was so popular in California, it was on TV. It was on the educational TV, and you'd see a room like this, you know. And one person would be in the middle of the room, a bit like Gestalt, you know. And they would bring up an issue, and maybe it was something that they were 3. And so they would just flood the person with those affirmations that they needed to hear when they were 3 years old. And it worked, you know. And often they would cry and then have some kind of thing, but then that issue was no longer there. So after I read The Healing the Shame That Binds You, which now I can't even remember... But then I got the Homecoming book, and it's actually like a workbook. You go through stages. You know, you need to work on this and work on this and work on this. So I did that by myself in retreat, but I did it in the context of what I'm teaching you, which is this Tonglin practice. And so what I did is I would do Tonglin with that stage of me. It's like inner child healing. You know, so I would think about, oh, okay, here's the 3-year-old me, and I would give myself, you know, whatever it was, And in some cases, there wasn't really an issue. But in other times, I'd have really interesting dreams those nights. I would go back and have dreams of situations with my parents or these kinds of things. And they would be healed with this. So, I really believe you can heal yourself. You know, not necessarily need a therapist if you have the discipline and the time and space to do that. I mean, maybe it's better to have a therapist. I don't know. But I've never had it. I went to EMDR one time. That was really helpful.
And I'm sure you can. Hopefully not everybody does, because otherwise I'll be out of business.
Yeah. But, his books are quite good. He was a alcoholic. Roman priest, a Catholic priest alcoholic. And then another book, since we're talking about this, we'll move away from healing ourselves today. But another book is Alice Miller's works. I'm sure you know Alice Miller's books. And one of them that I give a lot of people in retreat, it's got different titles. I think now it's called, I don't know, it used to be called Drama of the Gifted Child. And now I think then it was called Prisoners of Childhood. And now I think it's called The Drama of Being a Child. And it's a short little book. And it's very helpful because it explains... Like a lot of the reasons we are the way we are is because the different stages where that we needed from our parents to develop a healthy self-esteem. We need to be mirrored back as a child. You know, we need to be like, oh, now you're angry. You know, like, oh, this is, instead of being told, as like most of us, oh, you can't feel that way. You're not allowed to feel like that. And so we grow up not really recognizing what our feelings are, which is why it's so difficult then to practice Buddhism, because how are we to apply an antidote to a delusion when we don't even know what delusion we're experiencing? Or we don't allow ourselves to feel that delusion because we've spent, you know, our childhoods not feeling things because we weren't allowed to feel angry, we weren't allowed to feel sad, we weren't allowed sometimes even to feel happy, you know, because we grew up in pretty squashed situations, you know.
Another author who's quite current at the moment around shame is a woman called Brené Brown.
Oh yeah, she's great. Yeah.
I enjoyed listening to some of her interviews.
Yeah, she's on TED Talks and things like that. Yeah. And she's very popular right now. I heard one of her things. It was really good about shame.
She's really funny as well.
Yeah.
Really, yeah.
Yeah, and she didn't plan. It just sort of happened. And one day she had to give a talk or something, and it wasn't like she... I think she's not even got any psychological credentials or anything.
I think she's a researcher.
Yeah, she was
got funneled, because she was so good at it, funneled into giving public talks.
Yeah.
Research.
Yeah. So those are some tools to work with, because... these are, I feel, the preliminaries to the preliminaries, that we just have to do this kind of work before our Buddhist practice will really bear a lot of fruit, because as long as we, you know, don't have the capacity to recognize what's going on, then we can't do anything about it. So, yeah. So who would like to dedicate? Anybody? How about you? You had some things to say today. Would you like to dedicate the merits?
Sure.
Yeah.
We dedicate this to our friends and our family, our loved ones, our associates, our enemies, the people that we find difficult. And we give this over to sorry, I forgot what I wanted to say.
That's okay. So did Pauline. We can all do that.
I guess I dedicate this to to our karmic journeys. Thank you.
Thank you.